Welcome to Artists and Ancestors, a podcast where we explore ways to research and understand the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in learning about the everyday creative lives of people and the things that they made, this program is for you. I'm John Kay, your host of Artists and Ancestors. Hello and welcome to this episode 19 of Artists and Ancestors, Old Gravestones and New Technology. In this episode, I talk with scientist Jan Kai about his research doing 3D scanning of gravestones and rock art. This new technology allows scholars to reveal information and patterns thought lost to the ages. The way it works is he basically sets a laser line on the stone and measures the refraction of the line through taking pictures of it. He explains it a lot better than I do. Anyway, this allows researchers to measure depth and to reveal patterns that might not be noticeable to the naked eye. A senior systems scientist at SciLab, Dr. Kai is the founder of the Visual Intelligence Studio at Carnegie Mellon University. He's also a dedicated artist and stone carver, which is what attracted him to scanning both historical and prehistoric stone carvings. Since Dr. Kai's professional research interests include image understanding and ambient intelligence, he marries his interest in stone carving with his science to produce a useful tool and system, which he hopes someday to make available to the public. While 3D scanning does reveal faded data, he cautions that in order for this system to work, some residual information has to be present. So if big chunks are missing, you're just out of luck. This caution, coupled with recent escalation of erosion and damage to stones caused from acid rain and the like, makes this avenue of great interest to me as a material culture scholar and a very strong gravestone enthusiast. Well, let's move on into our interview with Dr. Jan Kai from Carnegie Mellon University.
Hi, my name is Jan Kai. I'm a research faculty in Carnegie Mellon University. I also lead a lab called a Visual Intelligence Studio. Myself is also an artist, and I do rock carving. And my scientific area is computer vision and robotics. And I do video analysis, and I teach multimedia, and also I teach creativity in Carnegie Mellon University.
Why don't you tell us about the type of research that you're doing now where you combine your work as a rock carver and a scientist?
Yeah, it's by coincidence. I do carving every Sunday and I work in the art studio in Carnegie Mellon. And I posted some rock artwork on the internet. And then I get an email from Italy, and there is a PhD student in archaeology. He sent me an email and suggested me to attend an archaeology site in northern Italy in the Volcamonica area. And because she thought my rock carving is very similar to the ancient rock carving. So I tracked down the summer school in Paspado city in Italy. It's close to the Alps. So I went to the summer school, and then I do a traditional archaeology study of Neolithic rock art, and I was very intrigued by the ancient rock art. It's about 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, and very primitive and very interesting work. And I know Picasso, he looked into the rock art when he was in France, and he's very impressed about those primitive art. So when I'm back to Pittsburgh, my colleagues think it's very interesting, and I did some 3D scanning because I have a 3D scanner, and then I tried to develop the technology to enhance the imaging from the scanner, and so my colleague Michael Strogan, he suggested me to test this system in the graveyard close to his home. That's in Scott Township near Pittsburgh. It's half an hour away from Pittsburgh. And there is a very historical church called the Old St. Luke Church. It's established in 87 in South Pennsylvania. There are over 100 historical tombstones, and many of tombstone surface are deteriorating because of weathering and pollution. So most of the tombstone surface, we cannot read it. So I'm starting to scan it and try to recover the words on the tombstone. So we did some filtering and clean up digitally, and finally we realized we can discover some words. It's not legible from bare eyes. So it's very exciting. Then I go back to Italy every summer for 4 years, and I use this same technology to scan the rock art in Vogelmonica, because that's the very intensive rock art location, because over a quarter million figures or rock art stones in Vogelmonica area. So it's like a mecca of rock art. So that's how we started.
Well, that's fantastic. We'll have to get you down here to southern Indiana, where all the limestone comes from, and have some great sandstone stuff. You can see some of the rock art that we have down here. Can you tell me a little bit more about you as an individual? You're this artist. Can you describe how you got started doing rock carving?
Oh, that's, again, it's serendipity. I do oil painting by training. Then one day I tried to do oil pastel on the rock surface. I bought some slates from Home Depot, and I put a pastel on top of a slate, and I don't like it. And I tried to use a knife to scrape it out. And then the knife leaves some marks, so it's like a scratch. And I found that the slates, actually that's a natural slate. It's a real slate. And the history is about 200 million to 500 million years old. So I found it's very easy to carve on the natural slate with just wooden carve knife. And so I started 3 years ago, and I had some exhibitions in New York, Chelsea Aerial Wood Fine Art Gallery, and I'm going to have an exhibition in the Florence biennial exhibition this December.
I think it's always wonderful when we're able to take our artistic abilities and combine it with our intellectual, our scientific work or historical work, whichever it may be, and marry those two together, because I think they're both stimulating the ideas of creativity, being able to take what it is that you enjoy doing with your hands and mapping it onto what you want to research as a scholar.
Yes, it also helped me to understand the history, because Pennsylvania, this is a church, Old St. Luke Church, is established by the British colonial. And actually, BBC was interested in this story, and they interviewed me before. And the history will show there is a big epidemic, disaster around that period, and a lot of children die very young. And I see some, I saw some tombstones carved. The baby died like 8 weeks. Some are just like 1 year old. And there was an epidemic problem over that time period. And also I learned, the culture of, at that time when the people carve the stones, and they some carve with some poetry, some carve with John Gee's opera, some words, some, poems from the opera.
Poems from opera.
Yes, it's the John Gee's Beggar's Opera. I think it's the English opera. So the priest of the old St. Luke Church, Richard Davis, actually he is also a historian, and he's about 85 years old now, and he also writer of this historical book about this church. So he recorded this previously, you know, the poetry from the stone. And then when we scanned the stone and we found out there were a few words is different from described in the book. So we discussed, and he's going to revise the book in the future edition. And it's a very interesting interaction with a priest. So we had actually had a seminar in the local genealogy meetings, monthly meetings in Pittsburgh. It's a Southwest Pennsylvania Genealogy Society.
Mm-hmm.
They have meetings. And it's a very amazing, the priest introduced me for the lecture. And I think I always get a blessed by a priest when you do your research, right?
That sounds like a good practice to have. You make sure you cover all your bases.
That's right. It's a very interesting learning experience for us. And we have students from Ukraine, visiting scholar from China. So it turned out it's just a very interesting working, learning, and interesting experience for everybody.
I wanted to kind of get you to talk about the scanning process a little bit. When you say scanning, most people think about this flatbed thing that's next to their computer, and it's nothing like that type of scanning. Can you describe the scanning process?
Yeah, we have several technologies. We try three. The most accurate one actually is very similar to the flatbed, but it's based on laser. And if you shoot a laser line, the very straight line, you know, laser, it's not point, it's a line of a laser, and then you will see the laser line will deform at the surface, right? And then we reconstruct those lines, become 3D. So first of all, we laser line just swept through the surface, and then we can see the profile of the 3D surface, right, the height. Then we put all those height profile together, and then we get a 3D image. And then we go to a computer, then we manipulate the 3D image and to clean up. For example, we do some mapping and map the height to the intensity, to the grayscale image. Then we can see the words. First step is we're going to bring the scanner to the field, and we sweep the laser lines across the surface, and then we get the XYZ points. And we get into the computer, then we use a 3D software to reconstruct the surface, either by 3D points or by rendering to the grayscale or pseudo color image. Then we do filtering, and we try to enhance the contrast, enhance the depth, and also we clean up the noises. So finally, we do, for example, OCR, optical character recognition,
mm-hmm.
or we can, you know, recognize some patterns. For example, we want to recognize this is a word, or this is a picture, this is an animal, this is a human, this is a bird symbol. And we actually scanned some rocks in the local Indian rock area. Also, it's a historical, about 1,000 to 2,000 years old rock. And we recover a lot of carving figures.
Mm-hmm.
And this methodology, actually, when we scan a larger scale, so we needed to stitch a small image into the big image. So we try many technologies and try to find out which way is the best. And also you need a separate battery to power the scanner, because in the mountain, in the field, we don't have the AC power. So we have to carry the battery and carry an inverter to invert AC to DC and to power this scanner. And actually right now in my lab, we try to create a next generation scanner, so it will be more accessible for average people But it just take a long time because I don't have a specific research grant for this project. So it takes a long time to take to make it become a consumer electronics, become a product. But we try to scale down, try to make this technology affordable and also make it simpler without computer. And ideally, people can take out a camcorder or camera, they can shoot some images and bring back to the home and can use a computer to process it and enhance it, finally get this results.
So you envision that people might even be able to do this without having to go through the scanning process, just with a camera? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's the same camera, but we can have some add-ons. So, for example, we can attach a laser line scanner, attach some components, just similar to some phone right now have a capability. You can scan your credit card with your phone. You can pay your bills through your phones. So this is my dream, my plan to work on, but it may take several years. And I get a lot of inquiry every year, and people ask me, have you done that yet? And have you implemented yet? And I think I'm still working on it, but it's just very slow.
I think that there's probably a lot of people who don't understand the nature of academic research and the amount of time that goes into applying for grant dollars, for doing your research, especially when this is kind of a pet project on the side, and how long it takes to bring something to, I would use a business term, to market. You're really talking about coming up with the ideas and then having to come through all the exercises to make them into something that's consumable for the general public is quite different than just doing the research that goes behind those products.
I talked to one government agency and asked for funding, and they asked me how many customers do you think we'll have? And according to their opinion, you know, even genealogists or historian interests, the market is not big enough for mass production. But I think people still can use this product to do something else. So like you want to scan your toy or some artifacts and then put it in the computer. So I think it's still possible.
Yeah, I know that in the business realm, this kind of rapid prototyping of using scanners for those sorts of things has really That's grown right. in the past 2 or 3 years even.
That's right. So even desktop manufacturers, 3D printing.
Right, right. And probably a lot of the listeners don't know about 3D printing, but basically if you have the AutoCAD file or the 3D file, you could actually – there are printers now that could allow you to print in 3D. So if you scan a vase, let's say, you could actually print out a copy, a tactile copy of that vase.
Yes, that's great. So imagine you have a scan of 3D data, and then you go to your 3D printer. You can print the surface of the rock just in – your office. Is that great?
I mean, it's amazing. And it could really change the realm of museums as well.
Yes.
So you could do one good scan of a priceless, one-of-a-kind artifact that file could be made available to schools, to other research organizations, and they could print them out to do their own measurements, their own analysis, without ever having to handle that precious original.
That's right. So it's a revolutionary because previously, like those historical data and archaeology data, they only exist in archaeologists or historians' desktop. And normal other people, they cannot access to it. They only can read the newspaper, read the papers, or find very specialized database. Now everybody can go to the website and can download. You can print out even people visually impaired, they can touch the surface. Mm-hmm. And they can really do all kinds of research. Maybe you can discover a new thing.
I think that this all sounds great. And I think that that is basically what the digital revolution has done, where it used to be scarcity. You could only have one of something. You could only listen to music when it was being performed. Then you could record it. Now you can distribute it to everyone. Same thing with objects. Now everyone can have access to this information, these pieces, not the original, but something that can give you a tactile and visual connection with something that for those who aren't able to travel to Italy, they might be able to experience something in a very meaningful way with that and do research for themselves.
Yes, similar to the Google Earth. People can right now use Google Earth and Google Street to virtually to travel to the place. Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about the future of this, wanting to create this product, this device that would allow it to get into more people's hands. What else do you hope to do with this type of technology?
Well, recently I got an email from the Reverend Richard Davis. He's still in the Old St. Luke Church in near Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Carnegie, PA. And he sent me an email to inform me, because I scanned about 70 stones, and we published some results on Old St. Luke Church's website. Mm-hmm. And that actually excites the families of the church, you know, some descendants of the tombstone. Some family, you know, they buried in the church mm-hmm. churchyard. So the church raised some funding, and actually to cast the scan results, recovered text on the tombstone in metal. So they put a metal plate in front of the tombstone so people can read.
Oh, that is amazing.
Yes. So I was very excited because that's the can see the our purely academic research become a very tangible, very tactile results. I think that's very rewarding for our team.
That is great. Let me go back to you as an artist and as a scientist. Has there been anything that, looking at all of these engravings and carvings as you scan them, are there anything that you've learned as an artist from looking at this work and that the scanner has allowed you to see that you might not have? Basically, I'm getting at that hand of the maker. Have you been able to feel like you get into some of the technique or mind of the maker in doing these scans?
Yes. Yes. For the ancient rock art especially, I get a lot of inspiration from those carving skills. Because actually, this kind of become a very interesting research topic. As in, you know, Iron Age and Bronze Age, mm-hmm. Even Neolithic Age, and they don't have too many tools mm-hmm. to communicate. And so you will see they have to use a minimal effort to communicate with maximal information. Mm-hmm. And so they're starting to thinking in a symbolic way. For example, they carve human, they carve the figure, animals, in a very elegant, figurative, but it's a symbolic. It's not down to very details. You're not going to see the facial expression or very fine details like modern paintings. But you will see the life and the interaction between the man and landscape, man and animal, and animal to animal, and hunting scenes, and mm-hmm. the rituals. It's very amazing because you actually look into human nature. You look into very primitive thinking. And also you can have a better understanding of human vision, human visual expression. So I really get a lot of information from the scanning previously not available. First of all, those weathered surfaces you're not going to see clearly. And now you can see very detailed in 3D. You can see the depths. So you can actually classify who made it, because you can see the signature of this carving. We call it a packing, the packing patterns. And based on the shape of packing and the depth of packing, and some rock actually have multiple figures overlay each other. And then you can separate them because you can see the packing patterns and also see the depths. So it was previously not available. Now you become, you have another dimension of information for study. And and also last semester, actually last summer, we went there with a 3D camera. So we have a studio camera and took the studio image. So when we come back to school and we actually bring those image to my class, video and a multimedia class, and we try to recover the studio image from those data. And it was very amazing. My students enjoyed it a lot.
I would be a big fan, I can tell, if I was one of your students there. It just sounds like being able to do such cutting-edge research, but also dealing with things that impact everyday lives of people, you know, the church there, and offering additional contextual information that has not been around since the stones were made.
Yeah, just imagine, you know, we have a 3D image, and a student can really look at and also enable other people to look at, just like in front of you. It's a very immersive experience.
Right.
So instead of you see the flat image, right now, because we did a 3D imaging, so we can see the studio three-dimensional image come out to your computer or your printout. And that's very amazing. Because right now, the 3D display is very hot consumer products. Product in the consumer electronics world, because I went to a consumer electronics show in Las Vegas in January, and the big topic for major TV production company is 3D TV, mm-hmm. 3D displays. But now you have a very cutting-edge device to display 3D, but we need a content.
Exactly. Meaningful content.
That's right. And also this is a culture and a very rich content, interactive content also. So people might share this cultural data all over the world, because, you know, China has a tremendous rock art collection, and Spain, France, Italy, almost every continent you can see the rock art, and people put those puzzles together. Maybe we can figure out a lot of interesting things about immigration, about origin of a human, about you know, the culture convolution.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because people found out some rock art Northern America is very similar to the rock art in China.
A few episodes ago, I did an interview with a folklorist, Tim Tangerlini, who actually is doing computational folkloristics, which is using Google Books, data scanning in, you know, thousands of texts and looking to basically recreate the context of people's lives from when those stories were collected. The fact that we're having this data is really incredible, because you can, for the first time, truly bring it all together through the computational methodologies. Of course, the problem which you alluded to earlier is unevenness, the fact that, you know, it will take lots of people scanning in this data in order to make it into research that is more meaningful, have more depth to it.
Yes. We still need experts, for example, from anthropology and from archaeology. And actually, I'm very fortunate to meet quite a few established rock art archaeologists.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Professor Chippendale in Cambridge, and Professor Angelo Fossati from Catholic University of Milano in Italy. And they study rock art for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we still need human experts to guide this technology to make a meaningful archive and also discover a lot of interesting phenomena.
Right.
Some actually try to combine the weather data, weather database, for example, NASA weather data in the last thousands of years, and combine those different database with the rock art database, and then you can figure out a lot of interaction between the culture and the natural environments.
Mm-hmm. I find all of that fascinating. The once you start picking at something, it just opens up into a whole new world. Let me ask you just one or two more questions, because I know you're a very busy man. I wanted to ask you about timeliness of the scanning and stuff. As someone who's studied a lot of gravestones and tombstones, both limestone and sandstone, whetstone, marble, different medium, I've noticed a great deal of deterioration over the past decade of information on these stones, which means there's more need for your work for analysis. But how about, are you seeing any real issues of timeliness in order to capture data before it's lost?
We discovered two issues. One is the angle of the stone really matters to the degree of deterioration. For example, if the tombstone is horizontal, then it deteriorates very fast. Because you have a vertical impact from the rain and will damage the surface quickly. And a vertical tombstone have less damage because, you know, the rain have, you know, less effect. And also the type of stone matters. Limestone and marble, they deteriorate faster than the sandstone. And a lot of sand rock art in Volcamonica in Italy are similar to the sandstone, and it's made by glacier. The surface was very smooth because it's smoothed by the glacier. And so it's pretty solid. But also vegetation will have an impact to the deterioration because it will create some cracks, and fire, especially forest fire, will damage the surface of the rock art. So we actually bring a lot of saws, chainsaws to the rock art mountain, and we try to cut down the trees close to the rock art. So we did a lot of conservation work. And also we learned we don't want to put any chemical stuff on top of a surface because they were, we don't know, you know, eventually might accelerate the deterioration. So we only use a wash. Water to wash the surface.
Exactly. The same thing has happened here in the United States about lots of people who are interested in being able to read what's on a gravestone. They started using shaving cream, and they put shaving cream in so you could see all the lines and stuff on it. And that has had just horrible effects on the stones long term.
That's right. So that's the advantage of this laser scanning, and because it's non-invasive, and it doesn't really break anything, it doesn't really touch anything. And if you really want to do imaging and want to see clearly, I would recommend, you know, find a good lighting source and try to search for the best angle, and you can do time-lapse photography, and you can starting photograph from the morning to the dawn, and so you have a very varied lighting conditions, and then you can use some software to simulate the lighting source, and you can get the best results from it.
Well,
and there is
a
software you can actually can synthesize the lighting conditions, so you can find out some words it's hidden or not very visible.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'll make sure if you can send me the name of that software and stuff, I can make sure I put it in the show notes for the podcast.
Yeah.
I have a feeling you're one of those people I could talk with for days about this type of research, but you've been very generous with your time today.
Yeah, well, It's my pleasure too. I always enjoy to share my experience with different discipline researchers, scholars, even just people just interested.
You've been listening to Artists and Ancestors with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by me, John Kay. I'd love to hear from the listeners out there to give me some ideas for future podcasts or folks to feature on the show. Let me know that you're listening out there. And until the next episode, keep up your research of the creative lives of people from the past.